Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go over to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the podcasts that are going on over there. I know you guys are all subscribed to that Christian History Almanac. That's the newest one. The newest podcast with historian extraordinaire Dan Van Boris giving you 5 minutes of church history every single day. Chad, you've been listening to this podcast? You checked this thing out?
I have, yeah. I've been learning a lot. It's pretty cool.
He brings out some like stuff that you never even heard of.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's exactly right. People I haven't heard of, or maybe I did and just have forgotten the kind of the details. And then I love at the end that he includes a reading from some famous poetry. I mean, there's just a lot of good stuff that's squeezed into 5 minutes.
Yeah, I do. I listen to this like every day when I'm like brushing my teeth and stuff. Like it's, it's 5 minutes long. So as I'm getting ready in the morning, you just pop that thing because it posts really early. And so you can listen to it while you're getting ready. And it's nice, man. It's got a calming element to it, too, because it's got that classical music and Dan's real chill while he's talking. And you're like, yeah, it starts the day off, right? So you should go check it out, the Christian History Almanac. Also, Chad's Academy course is out. It's out. So the day we're recording it, it's out today. The day this releases, it's been out for a few days, but that's still, you can go over there and enroll. So you can go. I know you're about the Old Testament because you're listening to this podcast. And Chad, you can watch Chad teach it. He's going to teach about Christ in the Old Testament. You can go over to 1517, go to the academy, and just enroll. It costs you nothing. You can learn from Chad for free. So check that out. And also, city event season is over. We just wrapped up Minneapolis, which was great. Had a great time there. Great hosts over there. But there's still one event, the big one, coming up in October. Here We Still Stand. The king of all events is going down, and there's still a few tickets left. I think there's about 60 or so tickets left for that event that they will not be there for very long. They're just going to sell out. But as a podcast listener, we do have a code just for you. So if you would go over, register, and then in the promo box, if you enter PNET19, as in podcast network, PNET19, you can get $25 off your ticket. $25 off your conference ticket as a podcast listener if you go over there and do that. PNET19. You don't want to miss it. If you haven't ever been to Here We Still Stand, you want to experience it. If you've been to Here We Still Stand, well, you already know. All right, Chad, where are we at in the book of Deuteronomy?
We are in chapter 8. We wrapped up, I think we pretty much wrapped up 7 last time, so we're going to jump right into 8 today. There's a lot of good stuff in here. There's some more New Testament parallels we'll be looking at, too. We hit one of those, I think, a couple episodes back, so we're going to look at another one of those today. Yeah, a lot of kind of interesting stuff that we haven't encountered before, or at least it's explained in a little bit different way in this chapter than it was before. So, yeah, looking forward to it.
All right, let's dive on in.
So the chapter starts out with kind of the typical Deuteronomy language. I mean, we're used to this by now. Verse 1, all the commandments that I am commanding you today, you should be careful to do, that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land which the Lord swore to give to your forefathers. I mean, all that kind of, we're kind of getting in a rhythm here. We know the way that Moses sounds. We know the kind of language that he's going to be using. So that's sort of a bridge from chapter 7 into chapter 8. But then when we get to verse 2, we have a little bit different focus with some, I guess you might call it divine commentary on exactly why all the stuff that Israel has been going through has been happening. So I'm gonna read verses 2 through 5. And then we'll talk about some of that, some of those details. So 2 through 5, you shall remember all the way which the Lord your God has led you in the wilderness these 40 years, that he might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. And he humbled you and let you be hungry and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by everything that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord. Your clothing did not wear out on you, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. Thus you are to know in your heart that the Lord your God was disciplining you just as a man disciplines his son. I think, correct me if I'm wrong here, Dan, but I think in those four or five verses, that there are like more New Testament echoes there than anything that we've encountered so far in Deuteronomy. I mean, I just reading through it, I'd say at least four, if not five, phrases or images jumped out of me that were just dripping with New Testament stories and theology as well.
Yeah, yeah. So you see this, Paul brings this up, the whole manna in the wilderness and all this stuff, but what immediately jumps to your mind is Jesus quoting to the devil that man shall not live by bread alone. So Jesus himself uses this as a weapon against Satan. And then it also brings up brings to mind John chapter 6. So Jesus in John chapter 6, Jesus feeds a bunch of people, 5,000 people, maybe the most famous miracle where he multiplies the fish and the bread and feeds 5,000 people. And then people are like, hey, let's keep that going. Like, how about you just provide lunch forever? Like, every day we'll just keep doing this. And Jesus does this.
Of course, he does this in the wilderness.
Yes, he does. In the wilderness. Right. Yeah, there's nothing to eat out there. And Jesus does this thing like, hey, I'm the real bread that came down from heaven. And their response is, hey, you know, if you're really God, God gave our fathers manna to eat in the wilderness. The implication is every day he did this. This is the implication. They're like, you know, this wasn't like a one-time deal, Jesus. Like, I mean, God gave them manna all the time. And then you see Jesus say that, well, that's not what you need. What you need is me. You need my body and my blood. That's what you need. So, yeah, those are the two that jump to mind immediately is Jesus using these words against the devil, and then the people using this story of manna in the wilderness to try to get Jesus to give them a free lunch in perpetuity, like just forever.
That's when he loses basically all his disciples.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. This is a hard saying. And yeah, the vast majority of people turn away.
Yeah. But I think what's great about this too is that he gives you the motivation behind this, and the motivation behind the 40 years, the letting you go hungry and then having God feed you miraculously, all of these things are to humble them. And that's actually a pretty gracious move by God, because it is. I mean, if you think about this, if God delivers you in the same way that he delivers the people of Israel, and like there's all these crazy miraculous things happening, and then you have the Red Sea and all your enemies get drowned and all this sort of stuff is going on, you might, like, as you pass through that Red Sea and get to the other side, feel pretty cocky. Like, you might be like, all right, let's go get that promised land. Like, we are legit. But God doesn't do it that way. There's the rescuing, and there's the humbling so that you don't think more of yourself than you ought, which is very, very important, it seems, to God, that God does not want his people to think that that they were saved because of who they are or because they're so great or anything like this. That he wants them to know that all of this is given from his hand, and that seems to be the purpose for a lot of the things that happen. And the way that he talks about this is that it's discipline. I think it's the famous Jocko Willink. Who says, the great theologian, Jocko Willink. But he says this, but I think it's true. You can be humble or be humbled. Mm. Like, these are the options. For 99.9% of people, it's be humbled.
Yeah, yeah. I know I'm not in that 0.01%.
Yes.
not that I'm boasting in my humility, but any experience in which, in the end, I am humble was always because I was humbled.
Yes.
It was never that I set out, you know what? You know what, I'm just feeling a little bit too cocky.
Yeah.
I really need to just take myself down a notch or two before I do something really stupid. or before something really bad happens to me and I end up humbled, I'm gonna take the initiative here and I'm gonna make sure that I don't think so highly of myself.
Yeah.
That hardly ever happens.
Yeah, never. That's never the case with me. I think it's, I mean, it's obvious, right? That these, like, the people of Israel are so much just like the rest of us, and God has to sort of beat them down into a place of dependency on him. And he does this over and over and over again. It's because that's the best place for you to be.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love the image that you use there is a family image, right?
Yeah.
It's a father and a son, right? So verse 5, the Lord your God was disciplining you just as a man disciplines his son. And really, I from the perspective of I have a son, he's 18, and from the perspective of a father, and I guess the same would apply to a daughter. I mean, that is one of the things you do as a parent, especially when your child gets to be a teenager. being a teenager is like synonymous with being cocky, at least for the guys. So part of what a dad does, and I'm sure part of what a mom does too, what any parent does is to make sure your kids don't get too full of themselves. Here's my point. You do that not because you're some sort of totalitarian tyrant who's wanting to just crush them. You do it because you love them and you know this is actually what's best, right?
Yeah, I mean, I explain discipline like this. Like my hope in discipline, I don't discipline my daughter because she disobeyed my rules and they're my rules and they need to be obeyed. If she has to be disciplined, which is actually not that often, but when it does happen, it's because I want her to learn how to be someone that other people like, someone that is helpful to other people, someone who's enjoyable to be around. I don't want her to not have any friends and to be someone that nobody wants to be around and to be a pain for everyone. Like that'll be a miserable existence for her. And so the goal is to make her, shape her into, and not to shape her into me, but to shape her into her, but a version of her that is best for her. And the version of her that's best for her is a version of her that cares for other people, that knows how to be a good friend, who knows how to not be selfish, who knows how to do all these things, right? That's my goal. Because it's going to be so much better for her if she's this kind of person. And I know we've talked about this before, that, you know, the wandering in the 40 years in the wilderness is sort of the teenage, the adolescent years of Israel. I think every guy, maybe not every guy, a lot of guys I know, at some point in their life, usually around 15 or so, they decided that it was time to figure out if their father was in charge of the house or if they were in charge of the house. So there's this moment that comes where you're like, I think I'm going to see if I can usurp all the authority here. Like, maybe I'm running this whole thing. And usually this happens is that you go and you decide to question your mother. This is usually how this happens. And then dad intervenes. I know this happened for me. And then you find out that you are indeed not in charge.
He found out you're not the alpha.
You are not. Am I wrong about this? Like, this seems like this always happens, especially with boys, that you're like, I'm going to go ahead and test and see if I can run this thing now.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And the consistent pattern is that's the way it works. It's usually not, you don't confront your father, it's your mother. Yeah. So you, and then dad steps in and you find out in the end what it's like to be humbled.
Exactly. Then you get humbled. Yeah. And this is, yeah. And this is what happens to Israel kind of over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I agree with everything you said about the reason for disciplining. And when you were talking, I was thinking basically the purpose of divine disciplining, just like the purpose of parental disciplining, is to drive home the fact that contrary to our assumption from conception onward, we aren't the center of the universe. So the discipline is to drive that home to us over and over. And of course, this is, it's not like we finally get to a point in our lives where we're fixed and you know, we got this down. We continually need this, but that's really what it's driving us toward, is to the acknowledgement, not just in thought, but in the way that we conduct ourselves, that the world doesn't revolve around us.
Yeah, this is why in the New Testament it says God disciplines those that he loves. In other words, if you didn't care about your child, you wouldn't discipline them because you wouldn't care about what kind of person they turn out to be.
Mm-hmm.
And this is true.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. And we've all been around people who, for whatever reason, conducted themselves in such a way that you could tell that their basic life assumption was that they were looking out for number one and the world did revolve around them, and to hell with everybody else. And I mean, I don't know about everybody, you and everybody else, but that's not the kind of person that I want to be around any more than a few seconds. You pick it up immediately, and the first thing I want to do is just get myself away from that person, because they're not just that they're not fun to be around, it's just like it's sickening to be around.
Right. Like, yeah. Yeah. Entitlement is not attractive.
No.
And we do see Israel walk around with some entitlement. And God says to smack them around. And they think that they just deserve certain things by virtue of existing.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's basically what Deuteronomy 8 is hammering home over and over. And it does this through various kinds of examples. But one of the examples that he gives here is that's the reason that God basically deprived you of certain things. So he didn't give them everything that they wanted or everything that they needed all of the time. So the example that's given here is that of hunger. So you shall remember all the way that the Lord your God led you in the wilderness these 40 years, and he might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you keep his commandments or not. And he humbled you and let you be hungry. So there was this element of deprivation, of not giving them something that they wanted or that they needed, in order that through that lack of something, they might realize that they weren't in charge, they weren't in control, that things were way outside of their ability to handle it, so that God, through his word and through his gracious fatherly care of them, would provide for them, and in that provision would teach them that the one they can rely on is not themselves, and what they can rely on is not any kind of effort that they put forth, but rather they rely on God's work and the promises that he gives there, which is basically what is happening in the wilderness, right?
Yeah.
I mean, not this, I meant like with Jesus in the wilderness.
Yeah.
So he does what the church father Irenaeus calls recapitulation. So he is basically, he has become all humanity. He's become Adam, he's become Israel, he's become us. And so he is going back through the stages of history. He's repeating the stages of history, repeating what happened in Eden, repeating what happened with Israel, repeating what happens with each of us, in order that in his doing of that, we might be doing that. In his fidelity, we might be faithful. So as a son, I mean, he's the son of God, but he's the son of Mary. He is fully human. So as a fully full human being, he undergoes suffering. He fasts for 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness, so that when the devil tempts him, he might respond in the way that we should all respond, so that in his obedience, we find our obedience as well. So that's what's happening in the temptations in the wilderness. This isn't Jesus using his divine power to show the devil who's in charge. This is him acting as a human being who is fully faithful to the word of his father in a way that is now our obedience and is our righteousness as well.
You know, what's interesting is that the statement that Jesus makes, that man shall not live by bread alone. It is this statement that man does not live by merely bread, but does not exclude bread, as in not you do live by bread, just not by bread by itself. Always love that statement, because I think the use of bread in that statement is intentional. What is being said, and when Jesus ties this in John 6, is that you cannot live by merely bread, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. However, when you do have bread combined with the word of God, you have something that does cause you to live, and not just survive, but live forever. This is why Jesus says, my body is the true bread from heaven. And so when you combine bread with the words of institution, when you have the sacrament, with the word of God, the promises of Christ, that this is my body broken for you, at this moment, you're not eating merely bread, but you are eating bread. So the bread is not absent. So when he doesn't say man doesn't need bread, he says man needs bread and my word. And there's a greater thing going on here. When you combine bread with my word, you will actually live forever, which is what Jesus says in John 6, that he who eats my body, like, believes these words, believes this about this bread, I will raise him up on the last day. So I think right here in Deuteronomy, you see this foreshadow of, like, think about it like this, a bread that is not alone.
Yeah, that's well put. I think that's why the church fathers often referred to the supper as the medicine of immortality, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because in eating this bread, which is also the word of God, mm-hmm. because, yeah, it is Christ that we are consuming there. When you consume him who is life itself, then you're consuming immortality.
Right.
I mean, yeah, so it's, in baptism, we're baptized into the death and resurrection of Christ. And when we consume the supper, we're eating resurrection food.
Right.
Because we're eating him who is himself, the resurrection and the life.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing. Next time you go up to the Lord's table, think to yourself, I am eating bread that is not alone.
Mm-hmm. I'm consuming the word who is life itself.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, that is great. Yeah. So there's a lot packed, a lot of New Testament stuff that's packed into this Old Testament section, and by reading those in tandem, it really gives you a great overarching perspective on the narrative of the scriptures, which I think is really that's what we try to do, of course, in the podcast, and I think that's what good biblical study and teaching does, is it demonstrates how the scriptures are like this vast web of interconnections. And by tracing those interconnections from Old to New Testament or from New Testament to Old Testament, you show that these aren't just kind of a collection of a variety of different stories, but it's actually, they're all part of the meta story, the one overarching story of salvation. And by reading it as this one, by looking at it kind of as a massive picture, you can see how every single detail is significant by itself, but every significant important detail is also part of that bigger picture of what God is doing. And finally, climactically does in the person of Christ. So anyway, that's a lot about the first five verses, but there's a lot there.
Yeah, we've been making a habit of that, a lot about five verses.
We have. So verse 6 takes us to really, I guess you could call this a section that is full of the various ways that God is going to bless his people, but at the same time, there's also a warning about the potential rebellion, almost a passive rebellion that could take place if Israel forgets this. So verse 6 again says, you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God, walk in his ways, fear him. Verse 7 says that the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land. And then we have this description of how it's a good land. Well, there's brooks of water, there's fountains, there's springs. There's verse 8 says there's all of these various kinds of crops and fruits like wheat and barley and fig trees and pomegranates. And not only that, but it's a land of that has olive oil and honey. And verse 9 says, you will eat food without scarcity. You'll not lack anything. In fact, I don't think we've seen this before. It says, a land whose stones are iron and out of whose hills you can dig copper. So, I mean, we got everything covered here, right? We got water. We got fruit trees. We got crops. We even have metals in the soil. I mean, there's what else would you want, right? I mean, this is the promised land. You can't get anything better than this. So verse 10, on the basis of all that, says, so when you've entered this land and you've eaten, here we have this theme of food come up again. When you've eaten and are satisfied, what do you do? Well, you basically remember who gave you all this. You shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which he has given you. In other words, when you've eaten and drunk and completely satisfied yourself for the life that he is providing for you, don't feel guilty. I mean, don't have any kind of reservations about, oh, I don't know if I should really be enjoying this as much as I am, or be thinking, well, this should really be something. I'm not worthy of this. Somebody else should be enjoying this, not me. None of that. Just thank God for the gift. It's quite simple. So don't say to yourself, wow, look at all the good stuff that I have provided through my own efforts, or look at all the good stuff that I have deserved, or look, you know, I've pushed myself so much and I've worked so hard that I've been able to attain this. No, none of that. Just simply receive it as a gift and thank God, bless God who has given you this gift. It's real simple.
Yeah. I think that, you see this term come up a lot, and it comes up a lot in church as well, to bless the Lord. And that can be maybe confusing. It's actually nothing could be simpler. To bless the Lord is to say thank you. That's it.
That's all it is. Yeah. Yeah. It's when God blesses us, he's given us a gift. When we bless God, we're just basically saying thank you.
Yes. Yeah, it's the acknowledgement that everything is coming from a fatherly hand, and we bless God by simply acknowledging that and saying thank you for the gifts you've given me.
Yeah, so you could say it this way. When we bless God, we're thanking him for the blessings that he's given to us.
He's not looking for you to repay him or anything like this. He's just looking for you to acknowledge that he has given you this good thing.
Yeah, in other words, God is looking for faith.
Exactly.
He's looking for trust in what he's done. And that trust, then the voice of trust is the voice of thanksgiving, which leads us into the negative reason, I guess, that Moses says what he says. Verse 11, it says, beware. Okay, so God's given all these gifts. We say thank you. Beware, though, lest you forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments and his ordinances and his statutes, which I'm commanding you today. Lest, and now he gets specific, lest when you have eaten and are satisfied and have built good houses and lived in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply, and your silver and your gold multiply, and all that you have multiplies. So beware lest, you know, when basically you have all of this, these wonderful blessings from God, verse 14, then your heart becomes proud, and you forget the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, and led you through the great and terrible wilderness with its fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty ground where there was no water. And he brought water for you out of the rock of flint. In the wilderness, he fed you manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you, that he might test you to do good for you in the end. Otherwise, verse 17, you may say in your heart, my power and the strength of my hand made me this wealth. This is Moses's way of reminding us way, way back of something which I think I speak for everyone here, with which we constantly struggle today. I've said this before in the podcast, and I've said it in a lot of different contexts, but the most dangerous time for us is when everything is going well.
Yeah, if you want to know why,
that is the occasion of pride.
Yeah, if you want to know why God doesn't give you everything you want, this is why.
This is it right here. Yeah, yeah. This is one of those mysteries of human nature. I think once you get to a certain age and have enough life experience, you know this cognitively. You know this to be true. And yet, practically speaking, it is one of the most difficult aspects of life to remember on an ongoing basis. Because the minute, I mean, I tell you from personal experience, the worst mistakes I've made in my life were always when everything was going well.
Yeah.
Yeah, because what happened was I have all this stuff, and instead of doing exactly what Deuteronomy told me to do, thank God for the gift, bless him for the blessings, I began to think in my heart, because of the strength of my own hand and because the wisdom of my own head and because of all this stuff that I've done and accomplished and et cetera, it's because of all that that I have this. So that's in the language of Deuteronomy, I'm not remembering the Lord my God. Instead, all I'm focusing on is myself.
Yeah,
that's the old Adam's work.
Yeah, there's a scene in the movie Castaway where he tries forever and finally makes this fire, and then like he's dancing around and saying, "Look at what I have done! Look, I have made fire!" Like, right? And it's probably appropriate in this sense because he's been working very hard at this, made this fire. But I feel like this is how we are with everything. Like God could give us all these things. Look at what I've done. Like, I am all that is man. Look what I have built. And this is how it is with everything. Look at the job I have. Look at where I have come from and how I have climbed this ladder. Look at my house. Look at my all my things, whatever it is, my family, all good things. I have done this. What happens is that when God gives us a lot quickly, we will most definitely think that was us.
Yeah, yeah. I love that. I'm drawing a blank now as to where Paul says this, but when he lists all of his accomplishments, you know, I was this and I did this and it's like he's giving us his resume, and then at the end, but I consider all of this nothing but dung, except he doesn't use the Greek word for dung, he uses the other word. In comparison, he considers all this dung compared to the knowledge of Christ, right?
Yeah.
To know Christ. Everything else, well, nothing else compares. And I think that applies in this case as well. So we may have all of this stuff, which most of us do. I mean, we are, from the perspective of the world, we are incredibly rich and we have so much. But ultimately, really what matters is the God who gave that.
Yeah, even when Paul does this and he says, like, I consider all this dung, this is not to say that, like, all the things that you have that God has given you are, in fact, dung, but by comparison, in comparison to this thing, they are nothing.
Yeah.
So even things that are good, things that are great, things that are gifts from God, everything that God has given you, which are things that you should bless him for, that you should thank him for, that are good things, when contrasted with salvation in Christ, are nothing. Mm-hmm. That's what he's trying. It's a picture he's trying to paint. Think about the best things you have. Now think about Christ. In comparison, the very best things are a pile of dung.
Yeah. And I think we could apply it. We all understand how this applies in our personal lives and our family lives, and I think we understand how this could apply on a national level as well, but I don't think we always think about how this applies also on the level of the church as well, right? You think about the church's life. Well, there's churches out there that have a lot of things. They might have a beautiful building. They might have a lot of money. They might have a lot of staff and just a lot of things that are material in nature that are a great blessing to the church, right? But what is all of that in comparison with having the gospel? Well, it's nothing, because that's what it's all about. So I think you could apply this personal lives. You could apply this on the national level. You can apply it on the church level as well. It's a matter of remembering that which is of utmost importance. And what is always of utmost importance is our unity with Christ and the forgiveness, life, and salvation that we have in him. Really, on a comparison level, nothing else compares, because nothing else is going to outlast this life. Nothing else has that eternal weight attached to it like Christ and his gifts do.
Yeah, I've said it this way before. No matter how much gold you have on the walls of the church, or how many lights or how much staff or how great your building is, which are all good. All of them are nothing compared to the gift of strange-looking bread and cheap wine on the altar. This is Christ, and all of them by comparison are nothing. Which is the upside down way that God works. I think you wrote a book about this, Chad. But
I think you did.
But this is how it works. Like, where's the real gift? Well, the real gift is like this thing over here, that everybody can have. Any whatever church building you're in, wherever you are, you can have this. So it doesn't mean the other things are bad, but if you compare the two, the one just far exceeds the other.
Yeah, Christianity has never been anti this world, right? I mean, Christianity gives thanks for all the gifts of creation. It gives thanks for everything from the clothing on our bodies to the homes in which we live, cars that we drive, the money in the bank, our jobs. I mean, all of this is a gift of God, and it's not. In other words, we're not like some of the ancient Gnostics that thought we had to shun all of this physicality and these things of creation because they were somehow tainted. Quite the opposite. These are gifts of God, and we bless Him for these gifts. We just don't turn them into idols, or turn ourselves or our belly into an idol, and forget the source of all of these things. And we remember that God, behind all of these things, is the God who gives these gifts. So it doesn't matter how hard you work at your job, the reason that you have a paycheck and the reason you have all those things that paycheck provides for you is because it's a gift. It doesn't matter, you know, how much you've been careful to save and how diligent that you are with your finances. Ultimately, everything that you're able to possess because of that is still a gift. The gift of God. So the focus is never upon ourselves as somehow generating all of these good things. Instead, the focus is always upon God who provides them through these external means that He always uses, behind which He hides as the mask of the giver.
Yeah, and you see Him make this point at the end of this chapter where He's saying the reason this is so dangerous is exactly what you said, that you'll forget the Lord your God and go after other gods. In other words, idols. In other words, you might even go after the thing itself. Right? So the warning is that you will fall into, you'll forget God. You'll forget the one who's given you all these things. You'll go after other gods, serve them, worship them, and you will, like all other nations, perish because you will disconnect yourself from the giver of all good things.
Yeah, it was a reminder to Israel that what set them apart was not their righteousness, as he's going to say in the next chapter. It's not their righteousness. It's not their moral bank account. It was nothing about them that set them apart. The only thing that set them apart was God's choice of them, God's love of them, and their faith in Him. And so they could very well end up like the Gentile nations whom they are going in to dispossess, because ultimately they would be tempted to actually in some ways become worse than those Gentile nations, because they would then make an idol out of themselves after God had given them all of these good gifts.
Yes.
So it's a great reminder of God the giver and us, those who bless Him and give thanks for the gifts that He provides.
Absolutely. And that's it, man. That's Deuteronomy chapter 8. We made it. And that
made
is 40
it.
Minutes. So guys, go out there and register and enroll. Go out there and enroll for Chad Bird's Academy class. You need to do it. Go do that. Check out all the other Academy classes while you're over there. There's a bunch of them. You can learn a whole bunch of things. We're about teaching you a bunch of all the things. So go and avail yourself of those. If you would like to support those things, all the things that we provide for free, you can go over to any of the sites, Christ Hill Fast, 1517, go to the donate page, you can become a supporter. That's how we're able to make all this stuff free, so we appreciate all of you who do that. Chad, I'll see you next week.
All right, see you then.